now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Chuck Missler calls the Bible an integrated message system from outside our time domain. But after watching the video that I just got done watching less than an hour ago, I'm not sure that Chuck really understands how right he is. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a filmmaker, a researcher, and lately anyway, a conference speaker as well. He is the partner of L.A. Marzulli in the excellent Watchers series, and he's got a new video out that I recommend, whether you're a skeptic or a believer in the idea of Torah codes or Bible codes. The video is the DVD, Torah Codes End to Darkness, and it's our honor to welcome Richard Shaw to the program. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking.
Well, I appreciate you letting us preview the Torah Codes DVD, which is, as people who've watched the Watchers series already know, your production values are excellent. This one you chose to host yourself rather than putting LA out in front of the camera.
Well, I mean, that's kind of like it was really his choice. I gave him the option if he wanted to host it, and he said, "Look, you're the experts on the Torah codes, not me. You should do the film." And so I said, "Well, I'd still like to interview." And he goes, "Great."
And his
contributions went down.
Yeah, his contributions are worthwhile. But as I said before we started talking, maybe I'm just getting more emotional in my older age here. But I can sense when I watch the Torah Codes video that this is a subject that hits pretty close to your heart. Is that an accurate guess?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been at this for a really long time, and the professors and rabbis that are in the film have become close friends of mine that I love and respect very greatly. And I've known them, at least three of them, since 2006, and had always wanted to do a documentary. And it wasn't until last year that funds became available to actually make the film. And I knew it would be expensive because we were going to have to go to Israel and stay there. We were going to have to fly to New York to interview Professor Haralick. And so all those expenses add up quickly. So when it finally came together, mostly in part to my thanks to David Greenhill, who had the presence of mind to offer to help get this film made, it wouldn't have happened without his support to get this rolling. Mm-hmm. And then we also had some Indiegogo contributors as well to help kind of bring it in home. But it was that made this film finally become a reality after all these years of research.
Mm. The website for the new film is endtodarkness.com. And the number of experts that you bring in, the stories that they relate, and some of the things that you include in the film that may not be, at least at first thought, wouldn't have crossed my mind as somehow relevant to the idea of Torah codes. But before we get into all of that, for people who may not be familiar with the idea of Bible codes, Torah codes, what are they? And follow-up question, why Torah codes as opposed to Bible codes?
Well, there was a best-selling book that came out in the late 90s, 97 or 8, written by a former Washington Post reporter by the name of Michael Drosnin, who's a brilliant writer, researcher, did a book called The Bible Codes. And on the front cover of that book was a Bible code table that said, Yitzhak Rabin, assassin will assassinate. And I read that book and I was really blown away by it. But never thought I would ever get to meet these guys who were the Torah code experts that were mostly residing in Jerusalem and New York. Through a very freak situation where a friend of mine happened to end up sitting on a plane alongside of what ended up being Professor Robert Haralick from City University in New York, my friend Lee, knowing that I wanted to do a film about it, connected without having to do anything myself. It was just really, really remarkable. So it took years to gain their trust, and because they'd been burned by various other film companies. The BBC was one of them, and other companies who tried to make it into some kind of a thing that basically went against the rabbi's own beliefs, which I respect the way they believe. It's a little different than the way I believe, but nevertheless, to work with them, I wanted them to be comfortable. And so we basically just concentrated on their work and on the research that they were doing on the Torah codes. And the reason I call it the Torah codes is because that's where all of the codes in the Bible are found. There's not a code all the way through the Bible, even though people are using the King James Version to look up codes all the way through the Bible. And when I hear that, I just cringe because they obviously don't know what they're doing. You can't be using an English transcription of the Bible and trying to find computer codes in it, because it's just, that's not the way it works.
So the codes are embedded in the original Hebrew and especially in the older Hebrew that makes up the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible.
Right. When you look at the Torah, it's written differently than any other set of books in the entire Bible. The Torah was given to us, given to Moses on Mount Sinai under very mysterious circumstances. And when he came down from those other Jewish manuscripts, which we basically call ancient Jewish mystical manuscripts, and these might be the Kabbalah or the Midrash or the Talmud. They have all of these other sources that the Jews use that they study, and they study these hard. Well, some of these ancient references refer to the Torah as being given with no spaces between the words. Essentially, if you unfurl a Torah scroll and hold it out in front of you, it looks like computer code. It doesn't look like a book. In fact, they used to have a stick that they would drag across the page to help them read it, since there was no spaces between the words. And centuries later, scribes started putting spaces between the words and even punctuation marks. But that changes the meaning of some of the text, which if you watch the film, you can see what might have happened in the film.
Right. Yeah, because placing a comma in a different place can drastically alter the meaning of a sentence. For example, let's eat, comma, grandma, as opposed to let's eat grandma.
exactly.
Yeah. So these scholars, now, when did the concept of searching through the Torah and looking for sequences of letters, if I understand this correctly, that are equidistantly spaced. How did this develop, and who stumbled onto this concept?
Well, it really kind of stumbled by accident by a rabbi in the 12th century, believe it or not. Rabbi Ben Achyar was looking at codes and found a 42-letter skip code in the Torah that basically, through not having a computer, just by counting with his fingers and using mathematics, he was able to use that skip and that word, the word that he found, to help determine the timing of the lunar calendar to get accurate times when the moon would rise and set for their crops. I mean, I don't know exactly how he did this. If you go to torahcodes.us, you can read the whole story about what he did. And the rabbis and mathematicians understand that aspect much better than I. But that was the first known Torah code ever found. Later, Sir Isaac Newton believed that there was a code in the Torah and spent about 20 years of his life looking for it. He found what they call gematria, which was basically numbers and words, and discovered some things like that. But he didn't really find the codes that we're using today. That didn't come until later in the 20th century when Rabbi Michael Weissmandel just believed that there had to be some other code in the Torah, some other information encoded in it, and started looking at it. Now, Weissmandel was a brilliant mathematician. His entire family was killed in Auschwitz, and he was raising money to pay for Jewish lives during World War II and was teaching them how to jump off the boxcars on the way to Auschwitz.
Oh, wow.
He ended up jumping off to demonstrate how it's done, and he fell and hit his head on the rail and was in a coma like for 24 hours. Family found him and took him to their house and nursed him back to health. His entire family was killed, and later he went off to study in New York and had some interns work with him, and that's when they discovered the whole equidistant letter sequencing code that's in the Torah. That's really where it started, was in the 1950s.
So the, obviously this type of work is made much easier by the processing power of modern computers. How did the introduction of the desktop personal computer change the research into the Torah codes?
This was after Professor Rips ended back in Jerusalem. And he had come from a background where his family had been killed in Auschwitz and had been living in Riga. And this was at a time where the Soviets were invading Czechoslovakia. And he set himself on fire at Freedom Monument to protest the invasion. And horrified onlookers came and put him out. And the KGB rushed up and took him, where he stayed for 2 years. At this point in his life, Professor Rips didn't know about God. He was raised an atheist. So some mathematicians got together. He was released after 2 years and sent him to Jerusalem. And when he got there, he saw this tremendous fervor of kind of rabbinical fever. That's all I can call it. Everybody studying the Torah, praying at the Wailing Wall. I mean, it was just, he'd never seen anything like it before.
And again, this is coming from an atheist who just got out in a prison for 2 years, a guy who was a mathematician by training, certainly not a theologian, and someone who, understandably, after seeing his family killed at Auschwitz, would question, you know, whether any kind of God would allow such a thing to happen. So his worldview is very understandable.
Absolutely. And I'm actually kind of, it's remarkable to me he wasn't more cynical than he was.
Sure.
So he, this, the Torah, and it really grabbed him. And in the interview, and I loved his comments. He said, I just loved it. But then it was almost like he felt like it was, in so many words, too good to be true. Mm-hmm. Because the Torah was full. He discovered that it was a book of miracles. And he was trained all through his college days that miracles do not exist. So he wanted to prove the Torah was true. And so he didn't know how to do that. He didn't have the money to go do archaeological finds to see if he could find some of those places that are talked about in the Torah or look through hundreds of historical documents. He wasn't financially able to do that, and he had other things he had to do in Israel. So maybe this book that talks about miracles, the key to those miracles, might be in that same book, he thought. So he met this other Neve, who had taken part of the book of Genesis and put it in a primitive computer. Now, this would be like 1976. So computers were just barely emerging on the scene. I mean, remember in those days, there was like Radio Shack made a computer, and Texas Instruments made one. And
the Trash 80, as we used to call it. Yeah.
That was it. I still remember those things. And then there was the Apple II came out.
Yeah.
That Steve Jobs kind of invented.
And changed everything, yeah.
It really caught on. And so when he saw what Rabbi Yaniv was doing, he realized that, well, they needed to write some real software that could help them look to see if there were other words they could search for in the Torah text. And back then, the computers didn't even have Hebrew fonts. I mean, you remember what they look like. Right. I mean, anyone that's seen these old computers, it's kind of flickering green letters on a black screen. Play the way computers look. There were no Windows or none of that stuff. And yet there was one font, and that was pretty much it. I think mm-hmm. the font was Courier or something bizarre. Yeah. So what they did is they converted every Hebrew character into a number and fed those numbers into the computer. And lo and behold, interesting information would come up every time. They'd look up the Vilna Gaon, which was a famous rabbi of the 17th century, a brilliant mathematician that believed the Torah was the blueprint of the universe. And his name came up in the Torah codes numerically. Hmm. Well, a few years later, one of the other gentlemen that's in our film, Dr. Alexander Rotenberg, decided that they needed a more graphic interface. And his idea of making the graphic look like a Hebrew crossword puzzle is what we still use today. Hmm. That's what the Torah codes, how they stemmed from, was Dr. Rotenberg's software.
Professor Ripps is interviewed several times in your movie, Torah Codes Into Darkness. And he... You know, again, maybe I'm just getting emotional in my old age, but just watching him describe the process that he went through was, very powerful. Because you could tell that this man who had been broken and badly hurt by losing his entire family to the Nazis, wanted to believe in something good, but needed some proof. When he shared with you, his experience of discovering that first code when they began to get into it. How did you read his emotions?
Well,
because this is many years ago. This is something that happened to him decades ago, but it comes through on camera. I'm just sensing, as you were sitting there in the room with him, what were you reading on his face?
Well, every time he tells me the story, there's another little piece of information that comes out that always touches me. And I have to tell you, Derek, it was hard editing it without my eyes filling up with tears mm-hmm. because Ripps is one of the sweetest, kindest, most brilliant individuals I've ever met in my entire life. And he's just a very special person. And, when he starts talking about the Torah as a book of miracles, and now he's in big trouble because he doesn't believe in miracles, it just really touched me. And of course, he has a smile that just takes your heart away. Mm-hmm. This guy is pure through and through. And he never would try to trick somebody or make something out of something that didn't exist. And that's why Ripps's tables that he does are so hard to refute, because his tables on pretty much any topic that he decides to take on have incredible p-values or probability values that they couldn't be done just by random chance.
Hmm. So what is some of the information that these codes have revealed that convinced you that this was the real deal, that these messages really have been woven into the very fabric of the Pentateuch?
I think early on, and I think most of the people that read the book that Michael Drosnin wrote back in the late 90s thought that, well, maybe the Torah is predicting world events that are about to happen. And that was kind of a scary thought, because that Drosnin made in his book for 2006 that there was going to be a world war and all of these other things, and none of those things happened. So then we were going, well, then what does all this mean? Because some of the tables are correct and some of them aren't. Well, we've come to realize that the Torah codes are not really, we don't have enough information to be able to predict the future with them, because that would mean we wouldn't need to know what was going to happen to look for those key words in the code before they happen. However, sometimes there are things that lead us into discovery. Like later on in the film, there was an example of a table about a terrorist attack in Tel Aviv. You may remember that. Mm-hmm. And there was a phrase that Professor Rips found that said mega terror. Which he found in the Hebrew text. And another Torah code researcher got that and did his own searching and found the words mega attack nearby. Now we always say that if there are two words that are sometimes they'll call them in best meetings of each other. In other words, where the words are almost touching, mm-hmm. or if the compactness of the table is there so that it tends to dissuade any chance that that couldn't have happened other than it being intentional, if you understand what I'm saying here. Mm-hmm. So then another Torah code researcher and mathematician went to the Wailing Wall, which there's a Jewish phrase, kotel, for the wall. Instead of hotel, it's like with a K. Mm-hmm. Went there to pray for mercy on it. The word mercy and on Israel are in the same table, almost touching those other words. So all of a sudden, everyone got concerned that there was going to be a mega terror attack in the month of Elul that year, meaning August of that year. And so Daniel Michelson, who was at the wall praying, prayed for God's mercy on Israel, that there wouldn't be an attack. Well, sure enough, there was a foiled terrorist attack where they were trying to fill a gasoline tanker truck full of explosives and blow it up at a depot in Tel Aviv.
Wow.
And Professor Rips went back into that same table and found the words basically scrawling over the top of the table over the other words that said, they will be arrested.
Well, this...
That type of stuff doesn't happen by chance. I'm sorry, it just doesn't.
Well, see, and that's one of the things that's always left me somewhat skeptical about the codes. And you mentioned earlier on that, the Bible codes, and especially those who are trying to draw these out of English translations of the codes, of the Torah or the Old Testament, are stretching it too far. And there have been those who've tried to use the codes to predict the future, and some clearly for financial gain. There was I'm not going to name this, but a very prominent television ministry that financed a movie about the end times some years back. You probably know who I'm talking about.
Sure.
And claimed to find in the codes that the movie was going to be a smash hit, which of course it wasn't. I'm just curious, what do the rabbis and the professors who are researching this, those that you have worked with, what do they say about trying to go to the Torah codes to find information about the future, given the Torah's prohibition, God speaking to Moses, against divination?
Well, Professor Rips wrote like a white paper and put it up online for all to see. I'm sure with a small Google search, anybody could find it, saying that the codes are not to be used like a crystal ball. Mm-hmm. And I agree with him in that. We don't know why sometimes it works, but we think it has to do with saving lives when it does. There's a reason when it works. And we have to be discerning to know whether we're looking at a true prediction or if we're just looking at something that's reflecting the zeitgeist of what's going on at the time. We believe the Torah codes do that as well. A great example was when I gave in the film about the year 2012. Mm-hmm. I had asked, the first time I met Professor Rips and Rabbi Glazerson was in Beverly Hills, California. I spent all afternoon with them and gradually, had to get to know them. These guys are very guarded. They don't just become fast friends with you the first time you meet. It's something they have to know that you're on the same page with them and that your intentions are pure in what you're trying to do. Because to them, the Torah is a sacred thing, and they don't want people dinking around with it. Mm-hmm. And so I asked them a question. I said, "What does the Torah say about 2012?" Now I know what Drosten's book said, because I'd read his book. and there was supposed to be various things that occurred. Oddly enough, one of Drosnin's predictive codes came true, but others did not. That's why it's very confusing. They did. They went back. I didn't realize, I know now, to be careful what I ask them, because these guys are brilliant mathematicians. If it's something that they don't know, they will continue studying about it until they know every aspect of it. They're very, very thorough. So Rabbi Glazerson and Professor Ripps started looking into 2012, and they were so shocked by the tables they were finding that I got a call from Professor Herlich in New York. And he said, Richard, you have no idea what you started. I said, I just asked a question, not knowing these guys right off the bat. And he said, well, yes, but he said, now they're making an appointment with the high rabbi in Jerusalem. He said, you don't realize how serious this is. I said, why are they making an appointment? And he said, for them to have permission to work on your film.
Oh.
And I said, okay. I said, Robert, I don't even have money to do a film yet. This was back in 2007, I guess. But I'm wanting to. And he said, well, we also looked your name up in the code and found it, and I just emailed it to you. At that point, all the blood ran out of my legs.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I didn't ask him to look up my name. And sure enough, I get to the computer, and it says Richard Shaw Pinlight, my company name and my name, in a very small table, which was really, really weird. So
yeah, if you're going to do a background check, you know, don't just Google. I mean, use the ultimate source.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was like my e-ticket to get to participate. And so they got permission from the high rabbi to work on the film with me. And they said he only stipulation was to not predict was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I would, of course, agree to that, because I don't believe anyone can do that. And I don't think any code's going to tell us the date of when the Messiah returns, although we might know the season of it. We don't know the date.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how it all started.
You spent a good bit of the film interviewing in Israel and touring some of the areas that are close to Gaza, areas that have been affected by violence in recent years. Dan Gordon, who is a fairly well-known screenwriter, I looked up the movies that he's written and was surprised that I knew almost all of them.
Yeah. And Dan's a great guy. He's a really talented writer.
And very good on camera, too. Captain in the reserves for the IDF, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. They call him a Sar-El volunteer.
Okay.
He was too old, actually. Wouldn't let them say no. So he can wear the uniform, and he kind of is like PR for the IDF. And he's very well versed on the whole topic.
Yeah, and I interviewed another gentleman recently who similarly volunteered as a Canadian who went over there beyond the age where you normally serve in the military, but they've got other things that need doing.
Sure.
Gordon relayed some stories to you that indicate that we know prophetically in the future there's going to come a conflict where God is going to intervene, and as he did with the Assyrians outside Jerusalem, the armies of Sennacherib, basically destroy an attacking army, or as he did with the Syrians on a couple of occasions when they were attacking Israel. But there seem to be smaller events that indicate that things that God still has a hedge of protection around Israel from time to time. One of the stories in particular is especially moving. I don't know if you want to share that or reveal that before the movie. I'll leave that to you. But there was another about where a newspaper even quoted a supposed terrorist source as saying their God, redirects their missiles or something to that effect.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, that could be – that's documented. That actually happened. The story that Dan relates in the film was basically there was a missile that was fired, and Hamas now has the very primitive Qassam rockets, but they also have the Fajr 5 and Iranian rockets that have some guidance systems on board that where they can actually aim it at a target and expect it to get fairly close. And those are the ones that most and why they've developed Iron Dome technology to try to shoot them down. Mm-hmm. Well, one of those larger missiles, which can travel many kilometers, was aimed at the Israeli towers in Tel Aviv, which is like this huge mega structure there. I mean, it's like, you know, it would have been like their 9/11 if mm-hmm. something had happened to it. And this missile was headed for it, and they shot two or three Iron Dome missiles, and they all missed. And so they hit the panic button saying there's going to be some major event happen here because we can't, our last missile just launched and it missed. And they have a very high percentage rate of hitting incoming missiles, but not, you know, they can't always get them, but they, most of the time they do. And at that point, and it was recorded on the Iron Dome computers, that there was a sudden gust of wind occurred and pushed the missile way up in the air and backwards, and it just plopped into the Mediterranean Sea and exploded harmlessly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way Dan Gordon tells the story, it's you know, the commander of the missile battery knew they had less than 4 seconds till impact, knew that their final missile would not even launch in time. And so he hit the panic button, which essentially is an alert to all first responders, security, you know, emergency medical personnel.
Right.
You know, we've got something. We're gonna have mass casualties. We're gonna need you right now. And suddenly, this missile just blows out over the ocean, and drops harmlessly into the sea. We'll save the other story. But when you watch Torah Codes, End of Darkness, watch for the story about the disappearing wheat field. That is marvelous. What were some of the more surprising codes that were shared with you by the researchers that you interviewed for the DVD?
Oh, well, there's a bunch of them, actually. I mean, one that Glazerson, Rabbi Glazerson and I become really good friends, and I love him very much. And he spends a lot of, he actually flew on his own nickel twice from Israel to Los Angeles just to hang out while I was editing on the picture.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought he was here to work, talk to someone about his books. He's written like 26 books. So I figured he was here for that. And later I find out, much later, he came just to hang out with me. So I have this rabbi walking through my house and going down to the refrigerator and getting coconut water, you know, which is really just great. And I'm just smiling from ear to ear when that happens, because mm-hmm. I love having him around. So there were some really amazing tables. And one day when I had him out in the car, he had his laptop in the passenger seat riding along, and I was taking him to Malibu. I said, we're going to go to Starbucks and get something refreshing. And I said, just relax. You've had a hectic day. And he's still doing Torah codes in the car. You know, I can't stop him from doing them. And I said, okay. He said, what should I look up? I said, look up something about the film. See if this was before we had the funding. I said, see if the film's going to get done. He said, too many words. I said, okay. Then look up whatever you think. And he said, I look up Pinlight. You know, so Pinlight is my company name. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, okay, great. I didn't expect anything to happen, quite frankly. He goes, oh, Pinlight, here it is. And it was in the Torah, like, I don't know how many times. It was in there a lot of times. And he said, here it is every 7 letters. Oh, here's a better one. Here's the word Pinlight every 4 letters.
Hmm.
And then he looked it up, and it was next Torah codes, Pinlight. And then at the bottom of the table, it said, as part of the plain text, I mean, it was like just words that popped out of the Hebrew text in this particular table said, we'll show the deeds of God to the world.
Wow.
And wow. I kind of went, that's a pretty good table, Glazerson. I mean, I don't know what to make out of it. I'm not bragging about it. I have no idea what that means, but it kind of stunned me. So in the film, he found another one that said, Pinlight will be distributed in 5775, referring to our movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it has my company name and this year's date.
5775 is 2015 AD.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All of the dates in the Torah codes are always predicated on the Hebrew calendar. That's how you have to look them up.
Sure. That's phenomenal. It's like, okay, pour out a drink offering or something. I don't know what we're supposed to do. You know, as Christians, I guess we don't have to, but I just feel compelled to.
Well, 2015, you have to imagine, is a very strange year. It's very odd. And these rabbis and professors are constantly sending me tables that they've been doing on their own just so I can see them, that talks about the Messiah. And I believe that most of them think that we're so close to the return of the Messiah that it could be this year or next. Many of them believe that wholeheartedly.
Hmm.
In fact, what's very strange is in Joel chapter 2, it says, the sun will be turned to darkness and the moon into blood. Well, anybody right. that's been following this knows that that happens this year.
Mm-hmm.
We have two blood moons and a solar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I mean, go figure. I mean, that's very strange.
I'm curious now, in the course of working with these gentlemen, and of course they rightly were very concerned about a topic that they take very seriously, and they should. They should be. In discussions of the Messiah, how deep do you go without it feeling uncomfortable? I mean, obviously, they've got a different view of what the Messiah means. I suspect that they would, as Jews.
sure.
How do those discussions go? I mean, do doors open for you to discuss matters of theology, or is that something that you just sort of set aside for the purpose of working together?
Well, there's both. I mean, there's times where I approach it from my point of view perspective. Like Glazerson found a table that said a very, and I mean, the smaller tables that only use a few characters and spell out like four or five words all crossing each other are more than random chance, in my opinion. I mean, the whole table only has, you know, 75 letters in it, and you've got, you know, all of this information crunched up together, I think that's more than coincidence. And it said, son of David, son of Joseph, you know, it talks about Messiah. And so I told Glazerson, I said, well, you know, to the Christians, that's going to refer to Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
But to the Jews, it could refer, I'm not sure who it refers to, but it has to refer to someone else, because they don't believe that Yeshua was the Messiah. Because to most of the Jews, especially the Orthodox Jews, rabbis believe that Yeshua was goes against the Torah, because to them in the Torah it says, "You shall have no other gods before me."
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they look at Yeshua as being one of those other gods, like mm-hmm. like a trick.
Right.
This is why that particular aspect of Christianity has been so hard for them to penetrate. And that's just, but that's their own belief system. Mm-hmm. And yet these are, as the scriptures tell us, that the Jews are God's chosen people. So it's just, you know, something that we, that I'm careful about, so that we can continue to work together. And all I can do is love these guys, which I do very much, and we work together in that regard.
And it's interesting, their eschatology involves a Messiah ben David and a Messiah ben Joseph.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So, they would not necessarily read that as, you know, because again, your first thought as a Christian is like, well, yeah, Jesus, son of Joseph, no problem. But
sure.
Their eschatology looks ahead to a Messiah ben Joseph, who is then supplanted by, or, you know, saved by a Messiah ben David. Chris White has done some research on that and looked into that. So,
yeah, and they always go back, according to our tradition, is the phrase that they use most of the time.
Yeah. Hmm. There's an aspect of the film that kind of caught me by surprise and had me running for my Bible, and the linear multiple translation website, and that was the discussion you had with regarding Deuteronomy 1 verse 28, and I had the gentleman's name in front of me now, and I've
That was Nir Studnitsky.
Yes, Nir Studnitsky, with an interesting translation on Deuteronomy 1:28. Now, the ESV translation seems pretty innocuous. This is from the English Standard Version. Where are we going up? Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying, these people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. But he translates it differently and shows how different marks, different punctuation would make that verse perhaps mean something a little more intriguing.
Yes, absolutely. I met Nir through a really close friend of mine, Bill Goldstein, who is a fabulous composer, wrote a lot of the music for the TV show Fame back when that was on in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And so Nir and Bill and I were out to lunch one day, and Nir said, I'm studying ancient Hebrew. Well, we're sitting here at Mel's Diner on Sunset Boulevard, and that's rather a strange topic to be bringing up. But nevertheless, he knew I was working on the Torah codes. So I said, well, that's interesting. What in the world would cause you to do that? Because he's still in his 20s. And he got interested in it. He realized that the commas and punctuation marks were added hundreds of years after the giving of the actual Torah. The Torah was given in the Hebrew calendar year of 2448. We're now in 5775, making the Torah, as of this year, 3,327 years old. And it's been played with a little bit as far as having spaces put between the words and commas inserted to help make it easier to read. So Nero goes in there and looks at the original Hebrew, realizes that these commas don't belong there and takes them out, and doesn't try to interpret the text, but just reads it the way it is. And it says there were fortified cities, huge fortified cities in the sky.
In the
now,
sky.
He says, though, there wasn't a word in those days for UFOs. And he believes that back then, instead of the way it is today, that there was open, active participation with people flying around in spaceships. And he uses a really great phrase in the film. He said, if you want to park your spaceship over there, it's okay. People were used to it in those days. And if you remember right, in the book of Exodus, there were all these strange things that occurred, like when Moses threw his staff on the ground, it became a snake. Well, The Pharaoh's high priest came, threw their staffs on the ground, and they became snakes. It was like old hat back then. Even in church is alarmed by that when they read it. And I'm going, excuse me? What's really going on here?
Mm-hmm.
How could that have happened? There obviously was something else going on, and there was also a re-insurgence of the Nephilim at various times after the flood that we read about in Scripture. So we really don't know everything that was going on in those days, but when you go back into the ancient Hebrew text, it starts giving us clues. And interestingly enough, in Matthew 24, Yeshua tells us that as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be during the time of the coming of the Son of Man. Now, the days of Noah were punctuated by lawlessness and violence, but also the presence of the Nephilim and possibly these space beings.
Yeah. It's really interesting because none of the English translations render that verse. Then again, it's Deuteronomy 1 verse 28 in that way. And this is in context. This is Moses recounting to the Israelites before they cross over into the promised land.
Right.
Their journeys since leaving Egypt. And he's recounting the episode that we read about in Numbers 13:33, I believe, where the spies in the land come back and say, oh, we're as small as grasshoppers in their sight and so forth. But there is a commentary at one of the Bible sites I'm looking at right now, the Pulpit Commentary, which says, literally, the Hebrew reads, their cities are great and fortified in the heavens. So, you know,
isn't that interesting?
it is. And I think it's the mindset, the scientistic, or perhaps maybe not that, but the positivistic bias of our modern translators to say, well, clearly they couldn't have meant in the heavens because we don't have cities in the heavens. So we must be talking about, you know, just really tall walls around their cities.
And that's what most of the English translations say, because they didn't want to believe that phrase.
Exactly. That, in fact, I'm looking at like 9 different translations right now, and none of them translate, you know, in the skies or in the heavens. Could have a couple of different meanings, I suppose, if you're talking about the Nephilim and the understanding that the people would have had in that day, because clearly they still had it in the days of Jesus, because we read about this in 2 Peter and in Jude. That the Nephilim were from the union of angels and humans. So, you know, they could say, hey, look, we're dealing with some semi-divine or divine creatures here. Their skies, you know, their cities are in the, no, we can't, you know. That was really intriguing that I'd never heard that before. And that when I had to go back and watch that again, it's like, okay, rewind. Let's, did I hear what I just think? I think I just heard. And that, it's just an interesting little tidbit, you know.
I believe like the conversation that I had with Professor Rips when I was in last time I was in Israel, I was sharing with him some of the work we'd done that I'd done with Ellie Marzulli in Watchers 8, and you know where we unwrapped this baby mummy skull that was elongated apparently at birth. It wasn't cradle headboarding. It was too young a child. It was born that way, in my opinion. But I was sharing that with Professor Rips and also showing him some pictures of UFOs that I'd gotten from various places just to see what his reaction would be. And his voice raised, and the hair on my arm stood up when he did this, because I've never seen him get so animated. He's a very calm person normally. He says, people have no idea what is really happening in this universe.
Wow.
And I just went, wow. And I told him, I said, Professor Rips, I said, there's times when you talk to me where I feel like I'm holding on to a live electrical wire. I mean, there's definitely, you can call it the Holy Spirit, you can call it whatever you want to, but there's something in the room with that man when I'm with him that I can't explain. And I believe he's been chosen to do this work. No one could ever convince me otherwise.
Hmm. Well, that comes through in the DVD when I watched it. Sharon will vouch for this. I was moved by the presentation. Like I said, I came into this skeptical because I just can't seem to get my mind around the idea that a computer search looking for equidistant letter sequences can pull this much information out against such huge odds, things that are specific.
Well, the Bin Laden table is hard to refute.
That was one. The one about the Tel Aviv incident was another. It seems, and maybe it's because the well has been poisoned by shysters who are seemingly able to pull codes out about anything and everything and predict the future, almost turning the Hebrew scriptures into, you know, 1-900 Miss Cleo, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. And one thing that I asked Professor Rips once in our discussions, I said, what is it that you would like to convey in a film that would be one of the key points that you'd like to get across? And he said, now, in just a few words, people can say codes can be found in any text. In that, it just means that it's all baloney. In just one sentence, they can disprove the whole Torah code phenomenon. So I thought, okay, we're going to tackle that. So I talked to Professor Herrlich, and I do this in the film. I said, okay, let's look in a few other texts and try to come up with the same words that Professor Rips found on the Twin Towers. and see how it comes up. Let's see if it comes up in these other texts that we're always talking about that's so easy to get codes with. So he does that. So the Twin Towers airplane attack Rips has in a table, I think it has something like 234 characters in it. It's all in there. It all appears in chapter 20 of the Book of Numbers. All of these words just appear in a little cluster. Bang, there it is, Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. So we look it up in other texts, 7,700 and some letters. Another one was 4,300 letters. Hmm. And all the words were there, but they were just spewed all over the page randomly. I mean, thousands of letters in between these words. Well, the computer could find them because it was a long enough text to where it could, but they don't mean anything. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
It's like comparing a junkyard to a brand new automobile.
Yeah. Or like you're taking something apart, but it has no, there's no relation between any of those words. They're not touching each other. They're not in columns next to each other. They're just scattered on the page. It's totally random information. Yeah, codes can be found in any text, but they don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, parts, pieces, as opposed to a cohesive whole. So
right.
Yeah, and I'm glad you addressed that in the film, because again, that going in was my reservation about the whole concept. And I think right now I'm like Professor Rips when he first encountered the Torah. I want to believe it. And yeah, the fact that so many have been found and the probability of finding words in those sequences in such a compact space in using so few characters is so high that it is compelling. And the gravity with which these researchers consider their work. They're not doing this like kids at a party on Friday night sitting down with a Ouija board.
No. And you can't pay them to do what they're doing.
This is very compelling stuff. Highly recommended. Richard, Torah Code, End to Darkness. Final question. Why the phrase End to Darkness in the title of the DVD?
That was what Rabbi Glazerson and... It might have been a threesome. Professor Herrlich and Professor Rips came up with, they did a book together called Torah Codes, Glimpse into the Infinite. And or because the Torah Codes, they believed was it's the end of darkness. Now we can see the light. We can look in and we can see what these codes mean. So Glazerson started doing these tables and believed that the end to darkness should be the point where Professor Rips realized he needed to start work on the Torah codes, and that was in 1976. So with the phrase into darkness that's in the film, in the Torah code table, comes up with that year in the same table and today's year, 2015. So it says into darkness 2015 and 1976. Hmm. That's what into darkness means.
Well, let's pray into darkness means the soon return of our Lord and Savior.
That would be great.
That was what struck me. Highly recommended. Richard, where do people find a copy of Torah Code's End to Darkness?
They can go on to the website intodarkness.com and click and order a copy. And eventually, I think we're going to see if people would also like to stream it. We may make it available for streaming. But right now, we have it on Blu-ray and standard def DVD. It comes in the same box. No matter what kind of deck you have, you can play it. I felt it needed to be in high definition because these tables are complicated and we wanted them to look sharp and crisp and clear on your big flat screen TV at home. So we went all out and did a Blu-ray of it.
Now we just need to get my eyes upgraded to HD and we'll be good. Richard Shaw is the producer, director, and host of Torah Codes End to Darkness, available now, endtodarkness.com. Richard, a pleasure talking with you today.
Same here. Thanks so much.
Links to follow the work of Richard Shaw and to get your copy of Torah Codes End to Darkness, just log on to vftb.net. They're in the show notes, as are the show notes going back 5 years for A View from the Bunker. In fact, with close to 300 interviews in the archives now, if there is a topic or a guest that you're interested in, I've been trying to tag all of the interviews with relevant keywords, and you can find those in the show notes at every every episode. But there's also a search box. If you go to vftb.net, look at the right-hand column toward the bottom there. There's a search box where you can type in a keyword or a guest's name, and it will bring up all the relevant hits for you. If you haven't subscribed with your podcatcher, that's the easy way to get all of the shows as they are posted to the internet. As soon as they go up online with iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcatcher you choose to use, the links on how to subscribe are, or the links to subscribe are there in the right-hand column at vftb.net. Coming up on the program, we're getting into a period here between February and March as we move that our schedule may be a little less regular than it's been for the last 6 months or so. I've been trying to hold to a twice-a-week schedule, Wednesdays and Sundays. This coming Wednesday, as you're hearing this, which would be February the 4th, don't have anything on the boards. Going to be spending a few days down in Southwest Missouri scouting out a place for my mother to live, and so didn't work far enough ahead to get one ready for the 4th of February. Coming up on the 8th, we talk about the Question Evolution Project with its founder, Cowboy Bob Sorensen, and the Question Evolution Day, 4th annual, comes up on the 12th of February, which, not coincidentally, is the birth date of Charles Darwin. So we'll find out what that's all about and how evolutionists can continue to hold their position when respected archaeologists and paleontologists are finding, T-Rex-like bones and Triceratops horns with soft tissue preserved, when there is no known natural process by which soft tissue can be preserved for more than a few thousand years. No, not even when frozen. So that's coming up on Sunday, February 8th. Also coming up, we'll have a return to the bunker of Dr. Doug with Dr. Doug Stauffer. We'll be soliciting questions about the pre-tribulation rapture. We did that with the pre-wrath rapture position. Alan Kirshner was kind enough to answer questions there. It seemed only right and proper to do the same with a spokesperson for the pre-tribulation rapture. And I'll be soliciting those here over the next week or so and putting those to Dr. Stauffer, and he will respond. We will produce that, and that'll be coming up toward the middle of February. But again, as we get closer to the moving date at the end of the month, things may get a little spotty in terms of our ability to get programs out with the right amount of preparation behind them. A recent guest here on A View from the Bunker needs your prayer. Dr. Catherine Albrecht, co-author of the book Spy Chips and host of the syndicated Catherine Albrecht Show, also the author of the new book, I Won't Take the Mark, a book about prophecy for children. Again, a recent guest on the program, required brain surgery this week, January 27th. Don't know what the diagnosis was that led to it. I know that she is a cancer survivor. If you heard the interview, you heard her describe some of that. The surgery, as of the 28th, we are told, is successful. And as I record this on the 29th, I'm working ahead a few days. As of January 29th, she is up and walking, which just 2 days post-op is pretty remarkable. She's on pain medication, as you might suspect, after having somebody poking around inside her brain. But she is recovering. She expects to be in recovery for 3 to 4 weeks. And during that period of time, a series of guest hosts will be handling her radio program, and Sharon and I have been honored with a request to cover a couple of days in the month of February. So we'll get you more information on that. As of now, it looks like February 9th, Monday the 9th, and Monday the 16th, we will be the guest hosts for Dr. Catherine Albrecht as she recovers from brain surgery, and our prayers are with her and her family for a quick and full recovery. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.